We're just a hair bit early. There we go. That looks good. I'm about 2 minutes early. You want me to roll or?
You mentioned the pointer.
Yeah, okay, the pointer. The pointer. All right, if you have pre-selected for your presentation to be recorded, okay, you need to use the mouse pad as your pointer. If you have not pre-selected or not give the Tri-Societies permission to record your presentation, we'll have a laser pointer right here on the corner, and you can use the laser pointer, okay? So, again, if you are having your presentation recorded and you give permission, please use the mouse pad as your pointer. All right, now I'm closer to time. With that, our first presenter is John Brecker, a master's student at North Dakota State University, and his presentation will cover soil potassium test recalibration and sampling time for corn in North Dakota. All right, John.
Thank you for the introduction. So today I want to discuss some of our work in North Dakota revising the potassium fertilizer recommendations for corn. Part of that involves soil test recalibration, and part of that involves looking at sampling time. And the reason we're looking at these recommendations now in North Dakota is the current recommendations were developed in the late 1970s and early 80s. And since then, we've had an increase in corn and soybean acreage in the state. Our yields are higher, and both of these crops export a lot more potassium in the grain than the old wheat rotations ever used to. So because of this, we're seeing a lot more low soil tests in the state. And as of 2010, a few years ago, 17% of the samples in the state were below that critical level of 150 parts per million. Additionally, we've seen a spike in potash prices. You know, for decades they bounced around $150 a ton, and then towards the mid-2000s they shot up through the roof, you know, peaking at about $850 a ton in 2008. Since then they've dropped down and they're closer to about $200 right now. And these are all reasons to look at soil testing recommendations again. But the big reason is that there's a lot of scrutiny over the standard method that uses ammonium acetate on dry soil, either air dry or oven dry. And the actual act of drying the soil samples has been shown time and time again to change the amount of extractable K. Usually it involves an increase in the amount of potassium extracted. So your laboratory number is an overestimation of what the plant sees in the field. Additionally, we see inconsistent yield responses to K fertilization. We have low soil testing soils that fail to respond. We also have high testing soils that do respond. So what's going on there? The ammonium acetate method doesn't assess non-exchangeable K. It's only an exchangeable K form, but we know that some of these non-exchangeable K forms might become available later in the season, so that might also explain some of these non-responsive low testing sites. And then there's also a seasonal variation in potassium throughout the season. Generally, it's highest in the spring and lowest in the fall, and that affects the interpretation of whatever your soil test number comes out to be. So the objectives of our study were to evaluate yield responses to fertilization, hopefully identify an adequate soil test and its critical level, and also to assess that seasonal variation. So to do that, we set out a set of potassium rate trials. Most of them were in the, in the Red River Valley, so fine textured soils. Then there's also a beach line along Old Glacial Lake Agassiz. So we had some coarse textured soils and then also some medium textured soils out in the till plain. And in the spring, we laid out our plots, which were our RCBDs, and we had 6 K rates going from 0 to 150 pounds of K2O. And these were all shallowly incorporated, about 2 to 3 inches, with the exception of 2 no-till sites. And in the summer, we took soil samples. Initially, we did 0 to 6 and 6 to 12 inch depths, and then we found out the lion's share of potassium at all the sites was in that 0 to 6, so we dropped the lower depth for the rest of the season. And we sampled every 2 weeks until harvest. And we found some good K deficiencies. You know, here you can see the classic chlorosis of the outer leaf margin. Here we have a picture looking at a treated plot on the right, non-treated plot on the left. So the check plots, you know, do show some good K deficiencies. And some of them just got outright nasty towards the end of the season. And for those of us in soil fertility world, we'd call that a really nice K deficiency. And so the methods we looked at, of course, was the ammonium acetate extraction. We used both the dry test, which is the standard method, and then also the moist test that Antonio Mallarino out of Iowa State has brought back from the dead. He's found it to be a better predictor of potassium response than the dry test, so we're taking a look at that. We're also looking at an ion exchange resin that incubates with the soil for a one-week period. You know, it has the ability to equilibrate with some of those non-exchangeable K forms. And then also the sodium tetraphenyl boron extraction, which is a non-exchangeable K method. We looked at a 5-minute extraction, which looks at both exchangeable K and that most reactive portion of the non-exchangeable K, and then also a 1-week extraction that assessed total non-exchangeable K. So just looking at the correlations between these tests, we see right away at the dry and the moist K tests do have a good correlation, which is good to see because they're both ammonium acetate extractions. But something nice to recognize is that that 5-minute tetraphenyl boron extraction also had good correlations with those exchangeable K methods, but it also assessed a portion of non-exchangeable K, so you know the correlation isn't perfect, which is good to understand. One thing I found interesting is that the resin K and the tetraphenyl boron K methods, both non-exchangeable, they didn't relate that well. So apparently the mechanisms and the pools that they're assessing are very different. In this graph, I've expressed the x-axis as moist K, and then on the y-axis is the dry K to moist K ratio. So here we're looking at to what degree did sample drying increase extractable potassium. And the line in the middle is the mean, which is about 1.26. So you see, you just can't multiply, you know, one test by the other by a simple factor of 1.26 and get the other number. That relationship is far more complex. It's a factor of the soil test level. It's also a factor of texture, mineralogy. And that's evidenced by these different lines, these different soils start to piece out. And I've been able to group some of these sites together, but that goes beyond the depth of the discussion I wish to offer today. So to look at the yield responses, here I just have everything slapped together. We'll summarize it in later slides. We had 7 of the 19 sites we looked at that had significant yield responses to fertilization. And this one here was a poor stand, so that explains why it's down around 100 bushels. But for the most part, everything ranged between 150 to nearly 250 bushels this year. So we've had some good yield potentials to work with to evaluate potential K responses. And here I've summarized the response frequency using the standard method based on soil test class. And you can see we have the number of sites that are in those categories, so they're fairly well distributed with the exception of the very low sites, which we hope not to find too often. And then also the probability with the responses here. And you can see in the medium and low textured, testing soils, some of these response probabilities aren't that great. We'd like to see something a little better. And if we just group them all together based on the probability of being below that 150 part per million critical level, the dry K test only predicted a response 50% of the time. That's not very good. So we have some major work to do there. And the questions start to be, what are some of the additional controls on plant availability of potassium? Is it mineralogy? The hydration status of the clays, if it's smectitic, illitic. So we have mineralogy data, and I'm currently working through some of that as well. But we'll just look at some of the response yield curves from now on. And on the left, we have the dry K test, and on the right, we have the moist K test. Apparently, the dry K test actually did have a better correlation with yield response than the moist K test. And we see the dry K test had a critical level somewhere around 160. We started to hit a plateau, but we weren't there yet. And moist K test is somewhere around 100 parts per million. So the moist K test is a little bit lower, but you know, neither of these tests are really strong predictors of potassium yield response. Here we have graphs looking at the sodium tetraphenyl boron extraction, the 5-minute extraction on the left. Actually pairs up pretty well with that moist test. So it's kind of in the running with the ammonium acetate methods. And then the total non-exchangeable K method with the 168-hour, 1-week extraction is is not really much of a predictor at all. But the thing to recognize is we still have some of these sites that just don't want to sit on the line at all. And really, those are the sites that we need to do a better job of predicting, especially for our farmer producers. The resin K, I haven't had the opportunity to run the 2016 data yet. But the 2015 data, it was just a linear response and wasn't significant at all. So looking at sampling time, we'll transition from the correlation data to sampling time. We recognize at all the sites, it was highest in the spring, lowest in the fall, which makes sense based on crop potassium uptake and also seasonal water dynamics. As plants use up water and stuff starts to dry down later in the year, potassium availability decreases. And one thing that we recognize is that you could describe this by a sinusoidal function at a lot of the sites. So here I have a lot of data, but I'll explain it. In 2015, 11 of the 13 sites we had could be describable by a sinusoidal function within themselves. So in order to present it to you today, I slapped them all together. And across the y-axis, you have a huge distribution of sites. But the thing to recognize is that on the high side, we have sites that follow this sinusoidal curve. And on the low side, I have sites that also follow the sinusoidal curve. And I'm able to summarize them all together following the same pattern across the season. So we do know that potassium is higher in the spring, and then it gets a little bit lower, and then it starts to increase later in the season, probably when we start to have some leaching of potassium from the residues into the soil. So we didn't harvest, my little cursor keeps disappearing, until over here, so there's some period where potassium becomes more available. In 2016, I tried slapping everything on top of it like I did in 2015, but the sites just didn't want to jive together because we had different moisture regimes across our study area. We had sites that started out really dry and stayed dry throughout the season. Then we also had sites that started out dry and then they got moisture later in the season, so that potassium release dynamic changed. But you can see at a lot of them, they still follow the sinusoidal pattern. And the seasonal range for some of these sites, you know, it's pretty substantial, you know, 40 parts per million. You know, that's a soil test interpretation category. That's the difference between maybe a medium or a high testing potassium soil, and that changes the K rate that is recommended thereafter. So to make some conclusions about our research so far, is that the dry test is not really a sufficient test for directing potassium fertilization in North Dakota. It works about half the time based on the current critical level. And based on correlations, the moist K test and the tetraphenylboron test might not be any better. But, you know, we're still looking. We're still trying to improve to find something that might be better. You know, maybe it comes down to these additional factors than any of these simple soil testing relationships show. Is it partly to do with the mineralogy, the smectites and illites? We think that's a huge factor, so we're considering breaking out our different response categories based on if it's dominant in the smectitic or illitic mineralogy, but still working through trying to categorize some of these sites, and maybe that can be a predictor at these in North Dakota at least. And the other thing is we do know that soil potassium tests do change enough within a season to change the interpretation class, but due to that sinusoidal relationship, it might be something that is predictable. So depending on if you're doing spring grid sampling in soybeans, you know, it's a common thing in the northern plains, you know, that it changes that interpretation compared to in the fall. But we might be able to work through that going forward. So I'd like to thank you for your time. I'd like to thank the North Dakota Corn Council for funding on this project and a handful of other people who have been instrumental in its development. And I leave you with a little picture of a thin microsection that David Hopkins, our resident podologist, he's been doing some thin section stuff, and you can actually identify nice feldspar minerals just by having a spectrographic scope. So I'll leave you with that and open it up to any questions. Thank you.
Got a couple minutes for questions? Yes, sir.
So the question is, in the correlation graphs, did I correlate with uptake at all? I do have tissue tammed for 2016, but for for time's sake, I didn't present any of it. We do see that the individual sites do respond well to potassium fertilization in their tissue or in their potassium content. However, when it came to trying to relate it to the soil test, like I did with yield here, it wasn't any better. It actually was worse because we also only had 2016 data, so the number of sets to work with wasn't that great.
Do we have another question?
You mentioned additional factors. Do you think these would be things a lab would need to measure or something that a consultant or a producer would have at one time?
So the mineralogy samples that we sent off to a lab in Canada, they cost about $300 to run. So am I going to tell a farmer to do that? Goodness, no. But one thing we're trying to do in North Dakota is take advantage of the NRCS mineralogy data that we have. Mind you, for the most part, North Dakota's mixed mineralogy. So what does that tell you? Nothing. But they have individual sites and pedons that have some good mineralogy data. We have the mineralogy data from my sites, and maybe we might be able to identify some of these illitic or high potassium feldspar areas of the state that respond differently. So as a tool, is it something a lab's going to do? I don't know, maybe if they want to, but trying to get a farmer to pay for that's another story.
All right, we'll have to hold questions for afterward. Let's thank our speaker.